Once again, as I said, my name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group. It's really good to be here. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 25th, I think. I'm going to tell you about that in a second. 1981, some of you have heard my story before. You're saying, wait, I thought it was January 17th. I thought so, too, until about a week ago. And then I looking on the internet, I found that for the first time, and I don't know where I made this mistake, that Super Bowl Sunday, which was when I had my last drink, having nothing to do with the Super Bowl, but it was Super Bowl Sunday, happened on January 25th, not January 17th. So for the last 30 years, I've been living a lie. and I finally got it off my chest, and I've been stealing like a week's sobriety when I didn't deserve it or something like that. I don't know. Whatever. But now it's out in the open, so you can disregard everything I told you up to this point. It's all a lie, you know. So it's good to be here. We're going to talk a little bit about step six or whatever. Who knows? Oh, my God, I had a thing here that I was going to read. Oh, there it is. I got something for you. It's not AA approved. It's not AA disapproved. It's not conference disapproved. In my constant, scurrying around the earth and trying to get things that I can read to you that'll piss people off, I went to an Al-Anon function with my lovely wife, and it was wonderful. It was a wonderful function. I went as the spouse, the Al-Anon spouse, and they would never let me speak at one of these things. But in any event, I happened to be sitting in a meeting, and they got these like Al-Anon Nazis walking around and everything like that. And they're wonderful people. I mean, they had some great speakers. But I was at one meeting, and somebody tried to read something or do something or talked about a book they had just read, and some gal jumped up and said, "It's not conference approved. You can't talk about that." You know, and I said, "Ooh." She wouldn't like me at all, you know. I guess Jesus is out of the question, huh? You know. Oh well. In any event, so there's nothing that's conference disapproved. You understand what I mean? It's no. Well, I guess you got to draw a line somewhere. Whatever. In any event, so we're going to get around to talking about six sense step six. But in any event, it says our book. By the way, about the book. I'm going to read some stuff. So you get something out of this, no matter what I say. I'll read stuff right out of the books, which is conference approved, by the way. And so this is like pure AA. So we of Alcoholics Anonymous, no one's start. Here's where we'll start. Because this book has become the basic text of our society and has helped such a large number of alcoholic men and women to recover, there exists strong sentiment against any radical change being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left largely untouched. So, hasn't changed at all. Well, it changed in one area, which I'll read you the area right now. I mentioned it. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show up other alcoholics. Now, listen to this. Precisely. How we recovered. And that's like in italics. I mean, the rest of it is like right there. It's like precisely how we... What do you think that means? Precisely how we recovered. Is the main purpose of this book. And it skips down and it says, the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. Well, they got rid of that word pretty fast. The rest is pretty much the same. Okay, here we go. Our book is at the second to last paragraph of the book. By the way, the step we're on, step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. In the big book, in this book, it's like one sentence. I mean, they got like chapters on step four, you know, on step five. It's like this sixth step is like, I think I got like one sentence on the sixth step, maybe two, on the sixth step, which is pretty interesting. Well, that's the way it's the mystery of the book. You know, they got like one sentence on the step that separates the men from the boys. Or maybe one of the most important steps that separates the men from the boys. It's like important. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. Now listen to this. We realize we know only a little. That's got to make you feel secure, right? you're reading a book that's going to save your life, written by these guys, you know, that, you know, really you wish you could be next to them and everything like that. And the last, like, they wait till the second last, the second to last paragraph to tell you they don't know shit. I mean, you're buying into this stuff. You're, like, loving this stuff. You say, these guys are like icons. He says, we don't know anything. We know nothing. You bet your whole life. You sold everything down the river for these guys. And they say, we have no idea what we're talking about. Good luck, you know. He says, we realize, you know, what you ultimately realize down the road, which if you told a newcomer this, they wouldn't believe it. The truth is, we do tell newcomers this over and over again, but they so don't want to believe it. They don't hear a word we say until they get 20, 30 years, and they say, this is what they've been telling me all along. Because all the big book is, all the Bible is, all these books are, is saying only one thing, and it's the same thing over and over and over and over again, different ways. It's just the same thing over and over again. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all things will be added unto you. Just focus on God. Focus on God. Focus on your relationship with God. Improve that relationship with God. Tell other people about the God thing. And everything else, you know, you'll know a new freedom, you know, new happiness, all sorts of, and you'll see how God is doing for you what you can't do for yourself. It's all about God. You know, if you think moral philosophy will cure you, you know, we don't have the needed power. That's why we wrote a book about God. You know, I know you don't like this. I know you want to hear it. You know, this sort of thinking has to be abandoned. We're going to teach you about God. You're going to believe in God. You're going to prove your relationship with God. And I mean, it's all about, you know, they just say it differently, different ways, you know. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little, and this is what they say, because it's the second last, so you ought to get it by now. So you know what they say? Guess what they say? So what are we going to do? If you know only a little, what are we going to do? They say, here it is. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. That's where your real reliance is. Sorry. I mean, I'm sorry. Not my rules. You know, personally, I would have laid the whole thing on like a new town car or something. But, you know, this is the way, you know. Ask him in your morning meditation. That's it? Ask him in your morning that's it? My whole, ask him? That's what you got to tell me? I'm dying here. I don't know how to pay the rent. You know, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? My boyfriend and girlfriend is leaving. My life is down the tubes. That's it? Ask God in my morning meditation? That's it? That's it? God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit some you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. Is right. Another way of saying it, see that you're righteous. That's like a churchy word, right? Righteous, you know, righteous, self-righteous, you know. See that you're right, you're righteous. You know what righteous means? It means righteous is a word that means right standing with God. Based upon God's standards, how do you feel? Not about your standards, you know. Yeah, I killed 15 people and raped a nun, but, you know, hey, I'm an alcoholic. You know? No, righteous. Yeah, because we rationalize. We tell ourselves rational lies. Well, I'm not as bad as Fred. I'm not as bad as, I'm not like, it's not, yeah, I killed 15 people. I'm not like Adolf Hitler, you know. See to it that it says that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass to you and countless others. So in other words, if you want to have great events pass for you and countless others, you ready for this? This is what I think. See to it that your relationship with him is right. Okay? Whatever that means. Guess what? You know what they say? They say, this is the great fact for us. You probably thought like step four was the great fact. Or step 10 was the great fact. He says, those aren't great facts at all. Those are just tools to get to the great fact. This is the great fact. See to it that your relationship, that you have a relationship with him, and that it's right, and then great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the records of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We'll be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, which is from, I think, maybe from 1 Corinthians, it's from one of the letters, Fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. And it even says, God will determine, you know what it says right here? It says, God will determine who your fellowship is going to be. It says, God will determine that, whether you meet us. So you must remember, this is what you have to remember. that your real reliance is always on him. That's what it says. It says your real reliance. It's not on me. It's on him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. So it's all about him. Which has something to do with the sixth step. Hopefully this stuff will sort of jive. Hopefully by the time we're done with these steps, I know I'm like a really, I know I sound like a broken record. No matter what step I'm on, it sounds like I'm on step three. Because no matter what step you're on, you're always on step three. Because all the steps are about step three. They're all about a constant, continuous turning over and dying to yourself and dying to your selfishness and not being selfish and self-centered and turning your entire life and your will over to him and thinking like he thinks, not thinking like you think about yourself and all that sort of stuff. And you turn yourself over to him and you become like him, thinking about others and everything like that, and then everything works out. You know, it's all about dying to yourself every second. It's all about, so if it sounds like a third step, because it really is, you know, whether you want to call it third, it's all about that deal. That's why they say this is the building blocks. It says this is the how and why of it. We got to play in God. There's only one God. If you sincerely take this position, what's the position? The third step position. All sorts of remarkable things happen. That's when they happen, when you take that position. They say selfishness and self-centeredness is the problem. That's our problem. It's not the booze. We drink because we're selfish and self-centeredness, and that sets up a feeling of restlessness, irritability, discontentedness, no matter what's going on. So we must get rid of this selfishness and self-centeredness, even though if we don't think we have this problem. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. God makes that possible. It says if a mere moral philosophy or different philosophy, we would have gotten sober a long time ago, but it didn't work for us. Because we're powerless. We had to find a power by which we could live, and that power is God, and that's why we have to talk about God. I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. Unless you don't want to believe it, and then it's like horrible. Then you're always looking for a way out or an exit sign or something like that. It's pretty straightforward. And once you see what the pattern is and what the deal is, it all sort of links up together. And then you understand how you turn your will and your life over to God. And then you start getting rid of some of these obstacles you have to his power. Because your sins, if you would, or your defects of character, however you want to put it, cut out the sunshine of the Spirit. Sunshine of the Spirit, his power is what comes in. This isn't a self-improvement program. You've tried this. This isn't like go to the psychiatrist self-improvement program. You know, his power comes in, and he's the one that changes the personality of the alcohol. He's the one who turns him from a drunk and a selfish person to a completely different person. It's his power that does it. We see to it that he is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. This is big book stuff. This isn't just my opinion. This is what these words mean in the big book. You can turn them around and make them mean anything you think they mean. So how do we have this power come? Well, you know, the anger, the resentments, the fears, all that stuff, that blocks out the power of the Spirit. So now that we have a relationship with him, you know, if you have a relationship with me, if you don't call me, if you don't write me, if you're pissed off at me, if you hate me, if you do a whole lot of things, that blocks the relationship with that you have with me. If you're an alcoholic like me, if you don't call somebody for one day, then it becomes easier not to call them for 2 days, then it's easier not to call them for 3 days, and then 6 years have gone down the road, and they say, have you spoken to your son? He says, no, I don't speak to him. And then it's impossible to pick up that phone because it's been too long. Because you're blocked off from the sunshine of the Spirit. So it's about constantly keeping in contact with God. Because if you don't keep in contact with God, you're lost. You're out there by Jupiter. So then once you get in here, we got to get rid of all this stuff. And we don't even know what the stuff is we got to get rid of. Because it's all blocking out that sunlight. And that's when we get into step four and we start learning about this stuff. We get into step five, we start confessing about this stuff and seeing this stuff and see how it's working in our lives. And now we start getting rid of this stuff. So we can be in a right relationship with God, because he doesn't want a relationship with phonies. Just like you don't want to hang around with some people. You know, today, you know, it's not because I'm stuck up or I'm a snob. I hang around with certain people. You know what I mean? I'll do anything to help a drunk, you know, has a desire to stop drinking. Or it doesn't have to be a drunk, just a human being who has a desire to get better, who's hurting. I'll do anything to help somebody. But I won't allow myself to be a victim. I'm not here for people to hang out with people who are just pulling you down, you know, and do not have a desire to get better and remain childish. And so I'm discriminating. You know, I no longer have to. If you see me with somebody or in some place, it's generally because that's where I want to be. You know, I don't find myself stuck in situations. What am I doing here? I'm here because I want to be. If I'm here, it's because I want to be here. I'm no longer addicted to having to be at places and then complain about it. You know, I can't complain about anything I'm doing, because if I'm doing it, it's because I'm doing it. It's not because I feel forced or any of that sort of stuff. And you know, that's the deal. And so, And so then we sort of start, we're going to start getting a little bit of a focus about the six-step deal. So I got this thing I want to read you. Now, it's kind of neat. This is a neat little thing. I think we did, what was the last one we did? We did the man who delivers the goods. Then before that, we did the guy in the glass. Well, this is, I just had it in my heart. I don't know what it is. So the Lord sort of spoke to me. I want to read this stuff to you, this thing to you. And now I'll give you a hint as to what it is. A little long, but it's okay. And I was trying to figure out why this was on my mind. This is one of these things that just sort of caught. Sometimes things happen, they come into your life. Remember it says, we know but a little, God will reveal more to you. Well, you know, God's going to reveal more. If you're on this path, he's going to reveal a whole lot of stuff with you that hasn't been conference approved. You know what I mean? Hey, I've run into a lot of really incredibly spiritual people, wonderful people that have helped me along who are not necessarily conference approved. You know, Bill Wilson, during the first 4 years, was guided, and for many years after that, by Dr. Sam Shoemaker and by Ed Dowling, the Jesuit priest, and they didn't read the big book at all. They were stuck on the Bible, and that's what he read. And, you know, they weren't conference approved or reading. There was no conference. You know, when they say rarely have we seen a person fail has thoroughly followed our path, their path didn't include reading anything that was conference approved. But there's nothing conference disapproved. You know what there is? There's just intolerance and fear. There's just intolerance and fear. That's all it is. You just have to worry about that stuff. So here it is. This is, and I was trying, you know, I was trying to think after why I love this thing so much, why I love it so much. And I don't know whether I have the answer, but I thought of an answer, which actually has something to do with what we're going to talk about tonight. So I'll give you a hint first, see if any of you know what this is. This is, has become history's most reprinted newspaper editorial. What I'm about to read you is history, in history, all of history's most reprinted newspaper editorial in the world. Okay? And I'm gonna read it to you now. I'm gonna tell you, and I don't know. We'll see. It'll be like a little experiment. Okay? 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Sun, which was like the New York Times. And the quick response was printed as an uncited editorial September 21st, 1897. The work of veteran newsman Francis Fresilius Church has since become history's most reprinted newspaper editorial, appearing in part or whole in dozens of languages, in books, movies, and other editorials, and on posters and stamps. Now, some of you may have heard this, some of you may have never heard this. It'll be a first for you. Here's what 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon wrote the editors of the New York Sun. And she wrote it in 1897. She said, "Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it in the Sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus? Virginia O'Hanlon, 115 West 95th Street." And here's the editorial that's the most reprinted editorial in the history of mankind, written by the editor and newspaper man. This is a hardcore, you know, probably hardcore editor, newspaper guy of what was like the New York Times back then. This is what he writes. You know, this might have something to do with us and our attitudes about things. It may have something to do with the sixth step. I don't know. He says, "Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except that they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant. In his intellect, as compared to the boundless world about him, as measured by intelligence capable of grasping the whole truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal life which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if you did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders there are unseen and unseeable in this world. You tear apart a baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, nor even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernal beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all the world there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus, thank God he lives. He lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood. You know, now I'll tell you, I read that. I tell you, sometimes I read that a lot. Sometimes I start crying. I said, what is it about that deal that impresses me so much? And I was thinking, I'm trying to figure out, it's kind of neat, but it hits me a lot more than just maybe what's in that. And I'll tell you what I think it is. What really impresses me about it, I never thought about this before, was that it's not so much as to what it says, although it says a lot. What impresses me is that a man, possibly a guy my age, who's obviously a very bright guy, a schooled guy, a cosmopolitan, urbane guy from New York who was successful, materially successful, reached the pinnacle of success in the newspaper industry, being like an editor or chief newspaper man of the New York, probably somebody who had a right to be as cynical and sarcastic, could not only write something like that, but actually believe that stuff. And then I think about the men I hung out with when I was drinking. I think even about some of the men I see in AA or I run into now, even my daily life and what they believe in and what they think and what's important to them. And there's such an incredible difference between what they focus on, what I focused on before I came into AA, and who I hung out with, and the people I hang out now and the man I am now. And what's really interesting to me is, I think of a guy like this Francis Church, who's long since dead, I'm sure. Probably a guy, he's the kind of guy, I'd like to hang out with, maybe have coffee with, maybe talk to, maybe has a friend or is a sponsor or something like that. And what I think about is he is the kind of guy. I hang around with guys like him right now. All my buddies are just like him. My sponsors are just like him. The people I hang with almost all the time are just like him. They believe like he believes. There are people that are like her friends, say it's all a bunch of bullshit, It's all crap, but I don't hang with them. I don't want any part of them. I don't want to be like them. I want to be like him. I believe in God. My life is God-centered. I'm not ashamed of it. My life is incredible. Because of my belief in God, I found a secret like Apostle Paul says. I've learned to be content in all things. Bad crap is good. Bad crap is good. Bad stuff is good. You know, when bad stuff starts being good, then it's hard to have a bad day. I can't explain that, but I just pray one day you understand what that's all about. You know, when the bad is good, it's hard to have a bad day. It really is. You know, when they tell you got cancer and it's okay, then it really is okay. As a matter of fact, it's damn okay. You know, thank you, God. Man, I have cancer, and I can help another person, and there's probably something behind this, and there's a lesson to learn up or down, and you're okay with that, and it's a good, and that's good. There's not much that can really put you in a bad mood. Probably a couple things. I'm not perfect. Nobody's perfect in here. We don't get perfect. So what does this have to do with the sixth step? Well, I don't know. I just wanted to read it anyway. It's a good excuse to read it. But I think it does have something to do with the sixth step. You know, it... You know, as I was talking before, I said, it says right here, because once I have this new attitude, I think the same sort of attitude that this guy has, an attitude that, you know, the cars don't matter, the stuff don't matter, the things that you see don't matter. It's like in Sermon on the Mount. That was one of the main books, the essential books of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the essential books was Sermon on the Mount. And in Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus says, he says, put not your trust on things that rust that you can see in the world, but on things, on heavenly things that don't rust and nobody can take away from you. You know, that's what he said. And that's what this guy is saying. The most important things in your life are things you can't see. Things you can't... I mean, there are people running around having heart attacks out there, just killing themselves, not seeing their kids, not seeing their wives, having horrible marriages, so they can earn extra money so they can buy a new Mercedes. And nobody on their deathbed ever said, I wish I had a better car. Or I wish I had spent more time at work. What's more important, running around and spending all this time and energy to get a new car or picking up your granddaughter at an elementary school? I mean, what's your attitude? You know, what's important to you? What do you focus on? Because if I learn what you focus on and I see who you hang, what you focus on will determine really who you hang out with. And who you hang out with, the people you associate with, will determine what's important to you. And what's important to you will determine what your attitude's going to be. You know, so what's important to you? What do you focus on? Well, I'll tell you what. If you focus on what I focus on, what happens is you focus on what I think this book wants you to focus on, and that is your relationship with God. I guess it must be that. When all of this stuff says, see to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. When it says right here in our book, our basic text, it says right here, it says God couldn't would if he was sought. And then it says right here, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Nothing about getting a new car in there. Nothing about getting a new job. It says just keep close to him and perform his work well. When Mother Teresa was being followed around by a guy from the New York Times or some reporter, he said to her one day while he was going up and down all the streets, you know, and all the poverty, he says, you know, I wouldn't do what you do for $1 million. She says, neither would I. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flow in, Well, the power is not from us if it's flowing in. If it's flowing in, it's not coming from us. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, I mean, how many people in here would like to have constant peace of mind, to have a quiet mind? Now, I'll tell you, if you're an alcoholic like I am, I don't know what kind of disease you have. I don't know about your disease of alcoholism, but my disease of alcoholism centers in my mind, not my body, and it makes my mind violent. I sit around, I have bad thoughts about myself and other people, and they make me feel crappy. And I have to run around and buy things and do things and do everything in the world to try to distract me about how crummy I feel about my life. What would you do to get rid of, I mean, look at the money we spend to distract ourselves in bars and lounges and banquets and tickets and concerts and everything we do to run around and spend and buy and shop just so we can have 5 minutes without having to think about ourselves. Because there's no way to escape you if you're you. The psychiatrists we pay, the pills we pop, the stuff we do just so we can somehow die without actually stopping breathing. You know, that's all drinking was, a way of killing ourselves but not actually stopping breathing. But what do you do when you can't drink and you got to live in your own body? What would you do to enjoy peace of mind? To face life successfully as we became conscious of His presence. Conscious of His presence. We began to lose fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter we were reborn. What would you do never to have to think about tomorrow in terms of fear? Or yesterday, what happened yesterday in terms of fear? Worry. What would you do to get, what would you give so that you wouldn't have to worry or get rid of worry? And then it goes on to say, when we get to step 5, it says, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator. There it is. I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. This is so clearly in the book. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I'm telling you the truth because maybe I the AA meetings I go to, this is all they talk about. I don't know why that is. I had one guy come up to me and he says, you know, after a meeting I did, he says, you know, I go to a lot of AA meetings and they never talk about God and the Bible and all the stuff you talk about. And I said, that's funny. I go to a lot of AA meetings too and they're always talking about that stuff. But I don't know what they talk about in AA. I don't know what they talk about in AA. Do they talk about this stuff? You know, when sometimes I'll duck into an AA meeting and somebody says, let's have a meeting on relationships. And then they'll start talking about boyfriends and girlfriends and sex and stuff like that. And breaking up and stuff like that. And I'm saying, is this an AA meeting or like Oprah? Because the only relationship I know about in Alcoholics Anonymous is your relationship with him. So you do the relationship with him is right, and all other relationships will be okay. If the relationship with him is right, everything else is just unhealthy dependencies. Trying to treat a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a husband or a father like God, like he's going to be there for you and do for you, and they're never there long enough. Because nobody can fit that bill except God. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. Why are we casting these out? We're casting these out so we can have a better relationship with Him. And ultimately, by casting these out, and doing an 8-step and doing a 9-step, finally get to the 11-step where we're constantly now improving this relationship with Him through prayer, through meditation, through talking to people. So we have this incredible spiritual awakening, and then do what? Tell other people about this. This is what we talk to other people about. That's why they say on page 29 where it says where we're going to set forth clear things. You know, what does it say on page 29? On page 29 of the big book, it says, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And so we get to step 12, and that's what we talk about, how we established our relationship with God. And some guy follows me out of the Carl Gables group, and he says, I hear you're a good speaker, but my sponsor says you talk too much about God. And I'm not sure what fellowship I'm in. Because I'm reading this big book, and it says it's all about God. And the fellowship's telling me you shouldn't talk about God. So who should I believe? A bunch of alcoholics that are sitting around a room sucking their thumbs? Or should I read this? Or should I read the book? Or should I read this thing? Should I read the book that says, because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such a large number of alcoholic men and women, there exists a strong sentiment against any radical change being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left largely untouched. Should I believe this book and what it says about God and my relationship with God, or should I believe you? Who should I look to? I've decided to look to this book. That's the decision I made. I don't worry about you or whether you like me or whether you don't like me, you know. You don't pay my Visa bill. You're not the one, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning when things are going down the tube and I got to look for something to hang on to. I don't think about you. You're not the one. You know, you're going to live and you're going to die and you're going to be here and there tomorrow. You're disposable. I think about this book and I'm thinking about what this book is a symbol of. Symbol of him. His message. And so we get to step 6 and it says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. Did you know there was a separation? I guess the girls from the ladies or women or something like that. This is the step. They could say step 3 or step 4. They say this is the step. Why this? Why this? Why we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character? That sounds kind of churchy. You know, in some contexts, when you read this book, they call defects of character where we miss the mark our sins. It's like sins, you know, missing the mark, not being right, missing the mark. Whatever the mark is, if the mark is being truthful, missing the mark would be less than truthful. You know, missing the mark. This is the step that separates the men from the boys. So declares, this is conference approved, so declares a well-loved clergyman, happened to be a priest, who happens to be one of A's greatest friends. He's quoting a priest, a clergyman, a religious guy. Well, what about all those guys in A that said, well, I'm spiritual, not religious? So declares a well-loved clergyman. Did they feel that way about religious people? Did the founders feel that way about? Were they pissed off? Did they have a hard on for religious people? No. Did they sit around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and put down religious people and talk about how crappy religious people are, like we do in some of the rooms I've listened to? I don't think so. You know, to me that shows disease. It doesn't show health. And what about the people that are scared to talk about God or religion or anything like that because they're scared that they may be judged or laughed at by the people that are cynics? You know, Virginia's little friends. They're all here. Virginia's little friends are all here. What he should have said is, Virginia, those little friends of yours are a bunch of drunks and they're going to be in AA pretty soon. I knew there'd be a tie-in somewhere. Yeah, we know about those skeptical people who are telling you there's no Santa Claus. Grow up, Virginia. Let's get a drink, you know. Get with it, you know. We know about those people. He goes on to explain that any person capable of enough willingness, honesty to try step 6 on all his faults without any reservations, whatever. It's like perfection. Well, that's like perfection. Yeah, it's like perfection. Don't get all upset about it, you know? has indeed come a long way spiritually, and now here's the test. I'm not making this up. Listen, I'm going to read it to you right out of the 12 and 12. Here's the test and the standard. Has come a long way spiritually and is therefore entitled to be called a man, or I guess a woman, who is sincerely trying to grow in the image and likeness of his creator. Now, if you understand the books they're reading, what that was all about, and they tell you about it in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Times and everything, you'll understand what that means. And if you don't want to understand what that means, don't read all the AA material. To grow it, so, I mean, if God is a doorknob, then I guess you're trying to grow in the image and likeness of a doorknob. You know, you can change the English language only so much where it gets ridiculous. Where it gets obviously ridiculous, and you get obviously ridiculous. And you know something? You try to shortcut the shortcut, you wind up nowhere. But if you read the words the way the words are really meant to mean, and be honest about it instead of being dishonest about it, it'll take you somewhere. And that somewhere will be in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you'll end up associating with men like this guy who wrote this deal. Entitled to call a man who is sincerely trying to grow in the image and likeness of his creator. You know, those men have an attitude like Francis did when he wrote that little girl. He had an attitude of, you know, he could have ignored that letter. And you know something? Here's a guy who was so bold about God and so bold about his feelings about materialism versus spiritualism. So bold about God and about all that stuff that not only did he answer her letter, he answered it in like the New York Times And he wrote it like in front page in the editorial section right out there for everybody to see. And people could have, especially in New York, people could have joked at him, made fun of him, said, what are you, stupid? There's something wrong with you. And it says what it says right here. So step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, is A's way of stating the best possible attitude one can take in order to make a beginning on this lifetime job. You know, people, when you separate the men from the boys, people who are involved in this thing and focused on God and want to have a right relationship with God, you know what? You know, they it's not that they're perfect, but they are convicted when they fall from the mark. I guess convicted is more like a religious word, so I'll put it this way. They have a feeling of guilt and a feeling of sorrow when they don't do as good as they know they can do. And they want to do better. And they don't want to do better so they can get the girl or get the guy or get the money. They want to do better because they know they're in a relationship with God. And they know they owe it all to God, and they feel sorry that they fell from the mark, and so they apologize, they confess, and they do better next time. It's not that they're perfect. It's just that the things that they desire and how they want to be in their lives, how they desire these things and the way they desire these things and what they want to be as far as inside themselves and their motivations are different than people that just want more money. And so the steps don't become mechanical to them. Becoming righteous or being right-sized or doing the right thing, do the next right thing, isn't something they sort of like do like it's a spiritual exercise. It's something they must do because it's part of being one of his kids and trying to be closer to him because he is the father and we are his children and you want to be close to him. It's just something that's almost natural, you know, because you don't want to let him down. And that's what separates the men from the boys. The people that are just doing this because they're forced to do it because it's a gun to their head, and the people that want to do it because they have an actual relationship with this because God is real to them. Some people, of course, may conclude that they are indeed ready to have all such defects taken from them, but even these people, if they construct a list of still milder defects, will be obliged to admit that they prefer to hang on to some of them. Therefore, it seems plain that few of us can quickly or easily become ready to aim at spiritual and moral perfection. We want to settle for only as much perfection as will get us by in life, according, of course, to our various and sundry ideas of what will get us by. And I know what it means to settle. I know what it means to say, well, it's not that good, but hey, it's good enough. To settle out of court instead of striving for perfection or to get better. So the difference between the men and the boys is the difference between striving for self-determined objective and for the perfect objective, which is of God. It's all about God. I mean, I'm sorry, you can't get away from it. Every single step is, how do you do these steps without talking about God or having a relationship with God? When every single step is about, he's the standard, this is what it's about. It's not settled for your own, what you think is perfect, but what God thinks is perfect. You know, I mean, how do you do this thing unless you have some conception of God that is wrapped around a value system of honesty and integrity and tolerance and responsibility? And how do you do this thing? I don't know, but I know part and parcel of my belief system as I developed in here, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and part and parcel of my faith in God. And I'm so far from anything close to perfection. Unbelievable. I suppose the day I die, I'll still be far from perfection. But I'm a lot better than I used to be. I'm a lot better than I used to be. And I hang around men. I strive to hang around men, you know, who are just, you know, farther down the road than me. You know, I mean, I think a person that's involved in this kind of thing, you know, this is just my own opinion based upon what I see in my own life and other people. When you're involved in this kind of life and you're trying to, you have a desire to not only not drink, but to get rid of these defects of character, you just do little but slowly, little but little, you just hang around people that ultimately are more, how can I say, spiritually mature than you are. You know, it started when my first days in AA. What did I do? I hang around guys with longer sobriety that weren't out there. There were guys in the parking lot smoking cigarettes and talking about getting laid and stuff. I didn't hang around with them. I don't take any credit. Like, look what a good guy. I just was never attracted to that. I was always attracted to hanging around with these old, overweight guys. You know, they were all over the hill. You're like me now. You know what I mean? Sitting around, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, talking about this stuff. I was attracted to that. And then all of a sudden, 5 or 10 years down the road, I get more attracted to hanging around with the guys and the 20-year guys and 30-year guys. And then all of a sudden, at 15 years or 16 years sobriety, I find myself, can you believe it, going to like church. What self-respecting alcoholic would find himself in like in a Bible study or in church? And all of a sudden, I'm hanging around guys in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, and they're not even alcoholics. They're just guys for the last 50, 60 years have been, studying the Bible. And I find myself hanging around with them, and I'm not even, intimidated by them. I'm not even scared of them. I like them. I like to listen to what they say. They say, like, amazing things. And the more I hang around them, the more secure I am. Next thing I know, I'm talking like them. Just like I started talking like my sponsor, I started talking like them. And I actually found my sponsor, who's not here tonight. He's flying up to Michigan. He's got 57 years in a Bible study. And next thing I know, all of a sudden, I'm hanging around more men and pastors and missionaries and stuff. This is just my own life I'm talking about. You don't have to do any of this stuff. And they may have nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, but they have everything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. These are the guys that Bill Wilson found himself hanging around with. These are the Sam Shoemakers. These are the guys that Bill Wilson, the Ed Dowlings, these are the guys that Bill Wilson went to for counsel. He didn't sit there and worry about whether they had read the big book or whether they took step 5 or something like that. He felt comfortable with these people. And I find that the more I want this thing and I want to get better, I find, what does it say when the pupil's ready, the teacher appears? Just look at who you're hanging out with, who you're seeking, who you're listening to, what you're doing, are you scared to hang out with? Why? I think there's sort of like plateaus in AA. I think there really is a separation. It says this is the step that separates men from boys. I think there are people in AA, and I've seen it before, that they can get 20, 30, 40 years, and somehow, somewhere around 10 years or 15 years, whatever it is, when, not that you should ever leave AA, but even the big book in the family afterwards starts talking about how once you get to a certain level and you start maturing, you got to start reaching out. It says, God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. It talks about the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience. You've got to grow in this experience. It's got to get bigger, not smaller. When you find yourself at 10 or 15 years and you're doing the same thing and hanging around the same people that you hung out with when you had 5 years, and it's not growing, that's why they talk about the family afterwards, joining a church or a synagogue. This is all a part of getting rid of these defects of character, getting better, hanging around with these people. I don't know about you, but I'm an alcoholic. And, one thing I learned about alcoholics is we're like chameleons. You know what I mean? You put me in this, I'm an alcoholic. Alcohol is my primary drug of choice, but you put me in a room with guys that are smoking dope, I'm smoking dope. I'm telling you. You put me in a room with guys that are snorting coke, I'm snorting coke. Put me in a room with guys that are drinking beer, I'm drinking beer. I'm going to be doing whatever you're doing. Well, you put me in a room with guys that are trying to live a righteous life and talking about principled things, I'm going to start acting like them. You put me in a room with guys that are cursing and yelling and screaming and running around and looking for all sorts of things, I'm going to be like them. So if there's one thing I know about me, is I know I'm very, very, how would be the word, influenced by the people around me and who I associate with. So if you want to get better, if you want to start growing in His image and likeness, you want to do this, look at who you're hanging around with. And look at who you could be hanging around with. And ask yourself, why aren't you doing this stuff? Why aren't you stepping out of your comfort zone and doing this stuff if you want to grow? I mean, it's one thing to intellectually take these things, and it's another thing to see where your feet are on a Sunday. To see what you're actually doing on a Sunday and who you're hanging out with. So thank you very much. Next week we'll do stuff about it. Either you're